Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Ni ser como na número 1. Mana pô, a disputa, muba muito que está na aí, tá aí a coisa na tarde. Será muito a coisa, mano, com a cabeça.
What's up, Mula? Tira, 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 tira Mama, Let your mama, ebongana nini
ebongana nani
Thank you.
China Global Television Network.
Ten soldiers among 19 people killed as militants defy a state of siege declared in two DRC provinces. Ethiopia designates TPLF as a terrorist organization. We'll bring you the latest details. And Israel mourns the death of 45 pilgrims on Friday. Welcome to Africa Live on CGTN with me, Beatrice Marshall, in Nairobi. Also ahead on the program. In business news, Egypt targets more economic growth as reforms enter phase two. Plus, we highlight efforts to get more women into top-level sports in Ethiopia. We begin in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where a militant raid has left at least 10 soldiers dead. They are among the 19 killed after militants attacked two villages in the eastern DRC. The attack happened hours after President Felix Tshisekedi declared a state of siege in the provinces of North Kivu and Ituri. The East has seen a surge in violence. Intercommunal violence has killed over 300 people since the start of the year. Well, let's cross over now to CGTN's Chris Ochamringa. He's in Kinshasa, standing by for us. Chris, what more details do you have about this latest attack?
Yes, so Beatrice, this attack happened on Saturday in Beni territory. That's in North Kivu province. That's a province that has had very many attacks since 2019 after the DRC government launched a large-scale military offensive against all the rebel groups in that area. No group has claimed responsibility, and it's not known yet who was behind it, but the officials in the area suspect it to have been carried out by the Allied Democratic Forces. This is an Islamist militia that's originally from Uganda. It's been operating in eastern DRC, killing very many people in that area. That's what the local authorities are saying. And there was also another attack besides the one where 19 people were killed, 10 of them soldiers. There was another attack of a Muslim cleric that happened later on Saturday. A popular Muslim cleric was killed inside the central mosque in Beni while preaching, while delivering a message to people. He's said to have been known to be preaching against Islamic radicalism, and people suspect he was killed because of his messages. It has shocked very many people in Beni, and people in Kinshasa and also in Beni have been protesting against this continuous killing of civilians in the area. They have been putting a lot of pressure on the president, who has deployed troops. Very many troops have been deployed in Beni and the northeast of DRC, Ituri province, where there has been an increase in attacks. And so people are still disappointed that the government has deployed people, but the killings are continuing to happen. Beatrice?
Well, Chris, we understand that the attack took place just hours after President Tshisekedi declared a state of siege in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Had anticipated security measures been put in place?
Well, they have been put in place. Now, this attack, the state of siege took effect immediately after the president declared it. That was on Friday. So the people there, what happened is that there was a restriction of the movement of people in and outside of North Kivu province and Ituri province. These are the two areas where there have been very many killings of civilians. And police were given the right to arrest people without any charge if they had reason to believe that someone was either a rebel or collaborating with them. He could arrest them, you know, without following the normal procedures. And so this was supposed to have taken place, but then it's a very complicated conflict. These rebels in Eastern DRC are people who live within the community, so they understand the terrain very well. They know who the soldiers are, and we've also been informed that some of them go to attack civilians dressed in Congolese army uniforms. And so it's very difficult for the civilians to distinguish between the genuine Congolese soldiers, the FARDC, and these rebels. And that is what has been complicating this whole the fight against attacks, against rebels in Eastern DRC. The president has said he's going to do everything necessary to ensure that he stops these attacks. He has already signed a partnership with the Kenyan president, Uhuru Kenyatta, to send in troops to help them to beef up this fight against rebels in Eastern DRC.
Chris Chamringa joining us there from Kinshasa with that update on the DRC. Now, Ethiopia's Council of Ministers has designated the Tigray People's Liberation Front and Shene as terrorist organizations. Once endorsed by Parliament, the decision will enable the government to take decisive measures against the groups and anyone affiliated with them. Here we see GTN's Girum Chala with more.
A statement released after the Ethiopian Council of Ministers decided to categorize both the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, and Shene as terrorist organizations reads, and I quote, "This decision will become applicable to organizations and individuals who collaborate, have links with, or relate to the ideas and actions of the designated terrorist organizations and others who have engaged in similar activities," end of quote. And once approved by the Parliament, this will give the government additional powers and legal ground to hunt down these groups and bring them to justice. The government claims attacks on civilians seen in the country over the last 3 years were either sponsored or plotted by TPLF and Shene. Shene likes to call itself the Oromo Liberation Army. In 2020, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered a crackdown against the TPLF after the group attacked the Ethiopian army. Some experts said the latest decision has the potential of assisting the Prime Minister to win the war against groups that are said to disrupt peace and stability of the nation. On the other hand, some also warn Addis Ababa should take extra precautionary measures while implementing the law to
forward to half-mast at public buildings, army bases and diplomatic missions. There is reportedly to be a moment of silence. The incident is one of the nation's worst peacetime disasters. Funerals have been taking place in several locations, including Jerusalem, after the end of the Sabbath. Stephanie Freed reports from the pilgrimage site.
The focus is on a number of things. First, identifying victims. 32 have been identified out of 45. Also, burying the victims. 22 people were buried on Friday, and that's according to Jewish religion. When someone dies, the aim religion-wise is to have a person buried as quickly as possible, and specifically before sundown on the Sabbath. Saturday, Friday night is the start of today. Saturday is the Sabbath. Among the victims, just to note, children, teenagers, two sets of brothers from the same family. Benjamin Netanyahu declared it one of the biggest catastrophes in the country's history, peacetime history. He also declared Sunday a national day of mourning. And I'm standing outside. I'm a little bit down the road from the pilgrimage site where this all happened. The investigation gets underway. It's already underway. The northern commander of the police said he's taken responsibility. He and the chief of police will be called in for investigation. You know, but looking at analysis, and analysts are saying that the police they're being looked at, they're being fingered unfairly because there were so many recommendations before this catastrophe took place to limit the numbers of people.
Violence is on the rise after the U.S. failed to keep a deal to withdraw troops by May the 1st. Taliban militants seized an army base in the eastern province of Ghazni late Friday. A provincial official said 25 security personnel from the base are missing. Also on Friday, a car bomb killed at least 27 people and wounded dozens in the neighboring province of Logar. Students were among the casualties. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned the attack and extended his condolences to the people of Afghanistan. U.S. President Joe Biden now says all American forces will leave by September the 11th. Here are some views from Afghans on the withdrawal.
There's nothing to worry about. First of all, we will not rely in that much on foreign forces, so that when they leave, we'll be able to continue. And secondly, the support that the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces needed, that support will continue.
Violence was at its peak ever since the coming of foreigners, and every day we witnessed suicide attacks and explosions.
The World Health Organization says the number of global COVID-19 cases has been going up for the ninth consecutive week. The death toll has also increased for the sixth week straight. US, India and Brazil are the worst hit countries in the world. India is facing the most rapid rise in new cases, reporting more than 300,000 new daily cases for 10 consecutive days. The World Health Organization Director General says there is a shocking imbalance of global vaccine distribution. Western countries have been criticized for stockpiling jabs, but Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says COVAX, the global vaccine sharing initiative, is still the best chance for many lower income countries to contain the pandemic. While India's devastating COVID surge continues, with almost 400,000 new cases reported in the past 24 hours, the country is also reporting its highest single-day death toll of nearly 3,700. The capital, New Delhi, was due to end a lockdown on Monday, but the measure has been extended by a week. More than 40 countries have pledged to help as vaccines and medical supplies run low. China has sent 61 flights to deliver supplies over the past 2 weeks. In April, China sent 26,000 oxygen concentrators and ventilators and nearly 3,800 tons of medicines and supplies. India has also received support from Russia, including 150,000 doses of the Sputnik V vaccine. While more restrictions have been eased across Europe as coronavirus infections drop, in the UK, trials on mass gatherings are taking place, with COVID deaths and cases continuing to fall. Andrew Wilson reports.
It's day two of a 48-hour experiment in post-lockdown behaviours. 3,000 partygoers packing out an airy venue in the city of Liverpool. The airflow and content is measured, testing for all before and after. For the participants, just a long-awaited party.
We're just excited. All of us are excited. We're all on the verge of tears, ready to go in. Honestly, yeah, we're not even drunk yet, so we're ready for it.
I have literally spent about 3 weeks preparing for this outfit. Oh, so long.
Genuinely,
deciding what to drink, deciding what to wear. It's been, honestly, big up Liverpool for having the first non-socially distanced event in the country. We love this city. We love this city.
England reported a drop in infections of 40% last week. Analysis shows that more than 22 million people now live in areas with no coronavirus deaths in April. Off the back of a kick-started vaccine program and a slight improvement in numbers, the French President Emmanuel Macron is now promising an easing of restrictions as well. For the past few weeks, says the government spokesman, the epidemic is losing ground in our country. It's happening slowly. It needs to go faster. We need to continue our efforts, but we can see that it is decreasing. The French government has announced a four-phase roadmap out of lockdown, including outdoor service returning to cafes and bars, and an easing of the nightly curfew from the middle of May. But although the French public is weary of restrictions, hospital numbers are still far higher than they were at this point in the previous two lockdowns. In Hungary, 4 million first doses of coronavirus vaccine, reaching about 40% of its population, has meant a similar easing of restrictions. Budapest Zoo has opened up again, but only to those with government-issued immunity cards. With its small population, Hungary has the second highest vaccination rate in the European Union and is the only EU nation to use vaccines from China and Russia in addition to Western jabs. Andrew Wilson, CGTN.
Meanwhile, here in Kenya, President Uhuru Kenyatta has lifted the COVID-19 lockdown he had imposed in March in the capital, Nairobi, and four surrounding counties. The move allows a reopening of religious services, schools, bars and restaurants. President Kenyatta has also revised the current evening curfew that starts at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Initially, Nairobi County and surrounding counties were treated as one zone, with residents barred from traveling to other areas. The country has recorded nearly 159,000 cases and more than 2,700 deaths.
With regard to the zoned areas comprising of the counties of Nairobi, Machakos, Kiambu, Kajiado and Nakuru, it is directed that the cessation of movement into and out of the zoned areas be and is hereby lifted. But the hours of curfew in the zoned area are revised to commence at 10 p.m. and end at 4 p.m. with effect from midnight on this day of May 2021 until otherwise directed. That in-person and congregational worship shall resume in strict fidelity to the guidelines issued by the Interfaith Council and the Ministry of Health. However, the attending congregation is still capped to one-third of the capacity of the place of worship. The operations of restaurants and eateries in the zoned areas shall resume in accordance with the guidelines issued jointly by the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Tourism and Wildlife, and restaurants are indeed encouraged to utilize outdoor spaces to maximize on physical and social distancing.
You're watching Africa Live. Still ahead on the program, concerns as resistance to malarial drugs increases on the African continent.
Africa is a continent of diversity, with varied climates and enchanting geography, and a people so distinct, but with a shared enduring spirit. We are at the heart of the continent to bring you the untold stories.
Let's have a look.
We celebrate Africa as it shapes its own destiny.
Adventurishi, Tunis, Cairo,
Zuba,
Ethiopia,
Tanzania.
Africa Live. Find your voice. How will your world change today? What happens here? What happens there? Or what you make happen for yourself? If it matters to you, it matters to us too. your stories, stories that need to be told. Africa Live, find your voice.
Researchers have reported clinical evidence that shows that drug-resistant mutations of the parasite responsible for malaria could be increasing in Africa. Despite the challenge, countries across the continent are doing their best to fight the disease. CGTN's Wilkista Nyabwa tells us more.
While her baby sleeps, Wilhelmina watches over him, trying to keep him safe from harm. There are many dangers lurking, and one of these is the constant threat of contracting malaria. Wilhelmina lives in Lokichar, a dusty little town in the country's north. The health ministry normally provides all pregnant women with mosquito nets because of their vulnerability, but one wasn't available at the facility she visited, and she fears that she and her child are vulnerable as she has experienced frequent bouts of malaria.
The last time I had malaria, the facility didn't have the medication in stock. I went to the pharmacy, but it was expensive.
The World Health Organization estimates that there are 229 million cases of malaria worldwide. The disease killed more than 400,000 people in 2019, more than two-thirds of them children. Malaria is caused by a parasite which is carried by female Anopheles mosquitoes, and now a study published in The Lancet appears to confirm that drug-resistant mutations of the parasite responsible for malaria are gaining ground in Africa. Drug resistance is not uncommon.
Drug resistance is a naturally occurring phenomenon, whether it is to malaria or bacterial infections. Anytime a microorganism, such as the malaria parasite, is exposed to a threat, such as the drug, there are a few parasites that will survive. These parasites will survive because they are resistant or because they are capable of developing resistance.
The most effective treatments for malaria are known as artemisinin-based combination therapies.
So this artemisinin compound rapidly reduces the number of parasites within the bloodstream, and the partner drug then clears off what is left.
Certain practices, however, contribute to drug resistance.
How we contribute ourselves to drug resistance is, number one, when somebody has a fever, not bothering to have a diagnosis, self-medicating. The truth is there are many causes of fever. It's important to give an antimalarial where malaria has been diagnosed.
In the trial cited by The Lancet, more than 200 children infected by the parasite received the standard treatment and were then monitored. 3 days post-treatment, about 15% had detectable parasites. Kenya has seen a 25% reduction in malaria cases in the country, a result achieved by putting in place strategies that include improving detection of malaria, having community management strategies that involve community health workers, and starting treatment as soon as possible. Drug manufacturing companies also continue to innovate. And across the region, as information spreads, ordinary citizens continue to do their best to battle the disease.
South Sudan's government says it is working to meet conditions set out by the United Nations Security Council for an arms embargo imposed on the country to be lifted. The UN Security Council imposed the ban in 2018 when a civil war was raging in the country. A peace deal is now in place, but the UN says the level of intercommunal violence remains high. CGTN's Patrick Oyet reports.
South Sudan's defense ministry says it is hopeful that an arms embargo could be lifted next month. The ministry says the United Nations Security Council wants unified forces currently in training camps graduated and redeployed. The UN also wants child soldiers demobilized and recruitment of forces by all parties in South Sudan halted. It also wants the country's army to be under one command. Currently, there are various armed groups which have been put together in training camps, but they are loyal to their leaders and commanders and do not take orders from South Sudan's president. South Sudan's defense ministry says it is working to meet the demands of the United Nations Security Council.
It is important that we address those issues holistically and not individually so that, you know, we can create that professional armed force, that professional police, that professional, you know, security agent. So it is a real challenge, the issue of the logistics, but the only way to address it is really to speedily graduate these forces.
The defense ministry says the soldiers in the training camps will graduate before the end of May and then be redeployed. The government says the delay in redeploying the soldiers is due to the lack of required funds for the payment of salaries, provision of food and uniforms for the troops. The UN Security Council is expected to review the arms embargo on South Sudan on May 31st. Patrick Koyet, CGTN, Juba, South Sudan.
Plastic waste management has become a topical issue, especially in dealing with the contamination of marine and freshwater environments. Over 500 million tons of plastics end up in the oceans each year. Some of the major contributors of this waste are from Africa. In South Africa, for instance, research shows that only 16% of plastic in South Africa is recycled. CGTN's Yolisa Njemela visited a small-scale enterprise in Johannesburg that is turning plastic into a usable product.
According to the United Nations, around the world, people buy about 1 million bottles per minute. Half of them end up in the landfills and the ocean.
The Environmental Affairs Department asserts that much of the plastic waste in the country's oceans, rivers and waterways is due to littering, inadequate waste management and overflowing landfills. But a number of South Africans are now attempting to be part of the solution. Mandle Nkosi Nkosi is one of them. He started a small entity called Man Recycling.
My biggest concern is the waste that goes to the marine and get burned. It damages our environment, the ozone layer, the marine. The climate change is so affected by the failure to recycle, especially in the rural areas. That's why I'm saying people must recognize this is a huge, huge opportunity for us to venture into a new business.
While always concerned about plastic waste in his community, desperation led him to this industry.
It was a matter of bringing bread on the table for my family. I was really desperate because I lost my job. I was not working at the time. I started slowly and small, but eventually grew to what it is today. I was towing a trolley from the street, and I managed to save very well, some good savings.
Then a short while later, his local municipality recognized his efforts and gave him access to many areas where he could pick up large amounts of waste. These days, Man Recycling operates from a secure building and collects over 18 tons of plastic waste a month. This plastic waste is then turned into usable products.
This is a storage site. It's like a warehouse. All this stuff that comes from this different transfer station comes here for sorting and the packaging so that we can send it to the correct mills. We collect a number of different products. The plastics, as you know, plastics are different. The beverage container plastic is called the PET. Plastics, we collect that and we sort it, package it according to the color. The clear ones one side, the green ones one side, the brown ones one side. We also deal with the HDPE. They call it HDPE. It is the plastic that contains most of the time the milk, amasi, your jig, your handy-andy, all that kind of set. The plastics are totally different.
Ngosi has recently been awarded a certificate from PET Recycling Company, or PETCO, in recognition of his work. PETCO supports recyclers with community programs, educational material, and awareness programs on recycling. Ulysses Njomela for CGTN in Johannesburg, South Africa.
In Egypt, some local artists have ventured into making sculptures out of spare parts and recycled materials, but this type of art is yet to gain as much following as other traditional art forms. In a move to highlight the potential of scrap art, One of Egypt's popular galleries has organized a special event to showcase this type of artwork. Here's Adil Mahouri with more.
Hossein Hissin has always been fond of sculpting. To enrich his talent, he decided to study his passion. He sculpted using all materials he could put his hands on, until scrap metals unleashed his creativity even further.
I'm a lover of my country. I always feel the urge to deliver art that reflects the rich civilization inheritance we have. We have a history which others should envy us about. With my art, I wish to emphasize the fusion of the traditional and contemporary. Together, they gave birth to these ancient sculptures in design with modern life materials.
Celebrating the 6th anniversary of his first public scrap art exhibition, Hossein is trying to redefine the Egyptian stereotype about that kind of art. Intentionally, he organized his display with a warm surrounding of paintings to his sculptures to highlight elegance of recycled art.
I was always fond of touring museums to admire the art of the scrap. I watched so many works that my mind kept thinking only about it. All my mental and visual capacities got engaged in my first artwork. Creating an art piece with scrap metal requires two talents, sculpting skills and talent of using welding and metal cutting gears.
At the gallery, he explains to visitors why such sculptures are quite costly, despite the fact that they're made up of recycled materials. He dives into details to show how he merged objects that are usually unattractive, like screw nails, nuts and wrenches, to produce a hypnotic sculpture unlike any other.
The cost material of this type of art is lost, but the time spent to create one piece is very long. The implementation is hard. To choose the right piece at the right place to get the visuals I plan is difficult.
Light penetrates and reflects over the metal surface to give this kind of art unique magnificence, a feature that is almost impossible with any other material.
I loved the variety he's presenting, from embodying our ancient Egyptian civilization to the modern rural life. The artwork clearly consumed a lot of effort. My favorite piece is the horse head. It stole my heart. There is harmony between the tiny pieces he used. The horse feels alive somehow.
This is what Hossein aimed to reach, to make people see beyond the cheap, ugly material used and realize the beauty behind an artwork that can take up to 4 months to create. Adel Mahoui, CGTN, Cairo.
And we still have more news for you here on the program. To stay with us.
Its effects are surreal, but its existence is undeniable. Mother Nature is fighting back against a species that is destroying.
We're here to raise our voices. We know that climate change has already started and it's killing us.
It hurts.
Amid the tears and the grief, however, there's hope for resolution.
We need to live in harmony with nature.
We focus on the deeds, the deals, and the people working to make a difference. This is Surviving Climate Change, only on CGTN.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
Egypt has launched the second phase of the economic reform program that it started in 2016. The new stage is aimed at creating jobs, attracting investment, and target growth rates of over 7% by the fiscal year 2025 to 2026. CGTN's Yasser Hakim tells us more.
The Egyptian government calls it a program of structural reforms to capitalize on the previous successful IMF-backed economic measures. It will target sustainable growth, make up for the losses incurred by the COVID-19 pandemic, and achieve ambitious growth rates of 7% in 3 years.
Achieving 7% growth rate is based on several indicators, such as the success in containing the effects of the coronavirus pandemic. The government is increasing public investments in different sectors, in housing, infrastructure, agriculture, in manufacturing by building industrial cities, while concentrating on IT technology and exports of goods and commodities to increase hard currency inflows and raise foreign currency reserves.
Influenced by the effects of the coronavirus pandemic, one sector that will see the most growth is healthcare. Public investments will increase by a considerable 205%, opening 23 new hospitals, increasing the capacity of current hospitals, raising the number of intensive care unit beds by 55%, and incubators by 10%. Improving the climate for private sector investments is also on the agenda. But a main priority as well is reducing public debt that has risen sharply to cover the anti-COVID-19 expenses.
The government has been introducing the budget.
The plan is aimed at increasing production. This will strengthen the Egyptian pound, which will reflect on the personal incomes and therefore provide a dignified life to the people.
Implementation of the second phase of the economic program is expected to begin in the new fiscal year from the 1st of July. Yas Hakim for CGTN, Cairo.
In South Africa, beef producers reckon the country has tremendous opportunity to grow its beef exports. Farmers and producers are keen to grab a share of the market. CGTN Sumitra Naidu tells us more.
South African cattle farmers have developed a reputation for the quality of beef they produce. The beef industry prefers to keep volumes smaller and pays attention to specific cuts.
We've got 41% of our local industries in the hands of the emerging sector. And what we're saying is if we get the buy-in from the emerging sector and get their animals also within this value chain, or there's already a lot of the animals that are in the value chain, but if we can do it, if we can get traceability done, we to a certain extent can include them more. And what we can do is we can expand on exporting to other countries.
Currently, South Africa exports 4% of its beef to the Middle East, China and North Africa. But industry players are looking to raise this to 20%. It will take time, though. Regulations in markets like the European Union make it difficult to expand.
Some of these countries, obviously, is very difficult to get into. EU is very difficult to get into with regards to, or specifically in the manner that we feed our animals. So there are other specific requirements that we might not be able to adhere to. But there are other countries that don't worry about these requirements, and we can export to them, and we need to optimize and use the opportunities that we have to those countries.
Disease also creates a limitation.
The one challenge that stands out is traceability, of course. So the European Union as a market focuses a lot, understandably so, on traceability of products. Where do the products come from? Can you trace it, what they call from the farm to the fork and things like that? And South Africa still has some work to do in that regard to satisfy those markets. By looking internally at taking our production and traceability to the desired level where we really can satisfy those markets.
The beef industry is the second fastest growing commodity in the agricultural sector of South Africa. With the government's focus firmly on growing agriculture, meat exports overall will benefit. Currently, Brazil and Argentina lead global exports. But local farmers will argue that the quality is far from what is found in South Africa. Sumitra Nadu, CGTN, Johannesburg, South Africa.
Nigeria's electricity problems have worsened after the recent failure of some of its power generating plants. The country is ranked second behind India among nations with large populations that have limited access to electricity. CGTN's Philly Hazard tells us how business owners across the country are facing hard times as a result of the chronic power outage.
Esther Mike has been running this salon for 3 years. She says due to poor electricity supply, she has not been able to make much profit.
Most of what we do here depends solely on electricity. We blow dry, we wash, even down to like treating of hairs. We use like electricity to do it. And then most of the time, like 80% of the time, we have to rely on generators. And then, of course, the fuel prices, like the whole thing has hiked, and we are barely making profit, really.
The World Bank reports that businesses and households across the country lose up to $29 billion annually as a result of power failure in Nigeria. The Ministry of Power says 16 out of 28 power generating plants have either suffered a breakdown, are experiencing gas shortage, or are undergoing maintenance. It's happening at a time when Nigeria's economy is just recovering from recession and businesses are still struggling to cope from months of shutdown last year due to COVID-19.
In the energy mix of Nigeria, about 82% of our generation stations depend on gas. So when there's a shortage of gas or an outage of gas, the power generation falls. And we also have even the maintenance culture problem. We have a backlog of broken down turbines that have not been fixed. We have no service maintenance contracts not being honored. You know, we have the preventive maintenance not being executed until there's a breakdown. Then we now go into corrective maintenance.
For years, despite investments in power, Nigeria has only distributed an average of 4,000 megawatts for its over 200 million population, far from a required 200,000 megawatts, according to the Association of Nigerian Electricity Distributors. Say beyond funding, the country's power grid is obsolete and needs to be decentralized from being mainly based in the south.
Why do I have to generate in the south and all the way to the core north? We have the different energy mix within the area. Look at the northern area, what works for them. It even put a less toll on the transmission network because you don't have to generate at all. There are losses along the line. There are lots of losses along the line. Then there is the cost of manpower to maintain the network.
The Ministry of Power has promised to rectify the problems and restore better electricity supply soon.
The government says it's in partnership with the World Bank, German firm Siemens and other private bodies to develop other sources of energy like solar to meet its goal of transmitting and distributing 25,000 megawatts of electricity by 2025.
And if that goal is met, entrepreneurs like Esther can make more profits and the country could in turn generate better revenue for its currently fragile economy. Phil Ihaza, CGTN, Abuja.
China is launching a month-long campaign in Shanghai to promote national consumption. It's held along with Shanghai's May 5th shopping festival. The event aims to accelerate the recovery of consumption. They're also trying to promote a strong domestic market under the country's dual circulation economic strategy. The promotion month is jointly organized by the Ministry of Commerce, CGTN's parent company China Media Group, and the City of Shanghai. And we still have more news for you here on the program. Here's what's coming up. Discovery of rare tombs offers a glimpse into ancient Egyptian era.
The greatest journeys. The greatest sights. The greatest adventures.
Here in Sanathar, this weir allows the locals to walk on water.
We're far more than just TV news. We're your passport to the wonders of Africa.
To bring you stories of struggle, survival and hope.
So let's explore. CGTN. See the difference.
Africa Live. Find your voice.
Egyptian archaeologists working on the Nile Delta have uncovered 110 rare pre-dynastic tombs. They date as far back as the period before Egypt's Pharaonic kingdoms, which first emerged more than 5,000 years ago. Yasser Hakim tells us more about the importance of this discovery.
It took a lot of effort to unearth these rare monuments in the Qahliya, 200 kilometers northeast of Cairo. What makes this discovery unique is that the findings belong to three different ancient Egyptian eras.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikwe, and welcome to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. Today, we're in the early morning hour of May 3rd, Monday, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. Let's thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And we just heard a news report from CGTN on a number of issues taking place on the African continent as well as internationally. Prior to that, we heard the music of Rock in Congo, album released in 1991. Right now, we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. These are a few of the stories that are in the headlines for today's Pan-African Newswire. The nascent economic rebound being witnessed in Zimbabwe, characterized by increasing industrial capacity, utilization, and stable macroeconomic environment, is a product of the country's dedicated and hardworking workforce that is focused on development. That's according to President Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe, speaking during a virtual address to mark the 2021 Workers' Day commemorations at State House in Harare on May 1st, the president said workers are the pillar upon which the Zimbabwean economy was emerging stronger from the COVID-19 pandemic. He said government will continue introducing appropriate policies to protect and improve workers' standards of living while allowing for businesses to thrive. And in other news taking place on the continent, Somalia's lawmakers voted unanimously on Saturday to cancel a two-year presidential term extension that they had approved just last month after clashes in the capital of Mogadishu between factions of the security forces, which are divided over the issue. In a speech following the vote in the lower house of parliament, Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble ordered the army to return to barracks and urged politicians to avoid inciting violence. The political crisis has raised fears that al-Qaeda-linked al-Shabaab insurgents could exploit a security vacuum if state forces split along clan lines and turn on each other. The group has taken over at least one Somali town in the past week as heavily armed fighters move from the countryside into the capital city. President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed's attempt to extend his term has also angered foreign donors who have backed his government in an attempt to bring some semblance of stability to Somalia after more than two decades as what many in the West call a debilitated state or a failed state. There was, of course, assumption of power by a government backed by the United States, United Nations, and the European Union. This took place during the late 2000s. On a contemporary level, the lower house voted, and it was broadcast on Somalian television and came shortly after Mohamed's address to Parliament and said he was directed the Prime Minister to prepare to hold delayed parliamentary elections. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and the current recently elected United States President Joe Biden has reportedly decided to uphold the Trump administration's controversial decision to recognize Morocco's alleged sovereignty over the Western Sahara. The recognition came as part of a deal with the despotic North African country to normalize relations with the Israeli regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken informed Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita during a Friday phone call that the Biden administration would not, quote, time being, unquote, reverse his predecessor's pro-Israel move in the waning days of his presidency. U.S.-based Axios News website reported, citing, quote, two sources familiar with the call, unquote, quote, the secretary welcomed Morocco's steps to improve relations with Israel and noted the Morocco-Israel relationship will bring long-term benefits for both countries, unquote, according to a readout of the call released by the State Department. Responding to inquiries about the issue during Friday's press briefing, the State Department Deputy Spokesperson Jelaine Porter attempted to dodge the issue. Quote, when it comes to Western Sahara, we are consulting privately with parties on how to best halt the violence there. We would also talk about having a goal to achieve a lasting settlement, unquote, she said. Trump's recognition of Western Sahara as part of Morocco reversed decades of Washington's policy regarding the disputed territory. It was part of a wider agreement with Rabat's ruler that included the renewal of diplomatic ties with Israel and the Moroccan regime that triggered massive protests in Palestine as well as Morocco. And finally, the Biden administration's U.S. National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has said that American diplomats will keep working to try to arrive at a mutual return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan and Agreement, the JCPOA, which is the Iran nuclear deal, on a compliance-for-compliance basis. Sullivan made the remarks in an interview on Sunday after Iran's lead negotiators said the third round of negotiations in Vienna to fully restore the 2015 nuclear agreement has concluded with some maturity and clarity, while there remains a lengthy and bumpy road ahead. Sullivan also acknowledged that Washington and Tehran are not close to an agreement to revive U.S. participation in the nuclear pact, which has reached between Iran and the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the European Union in 2015. According to the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, quote, there's no deal now, unquote. And with that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, and journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you would like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, May 2nd, 2021, in the early morning hour of Monday, May 3rd, 2021, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network, com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program.
like lightning. The bells all shine like gold. Now don't you hear me talking, baby? Smoke like lightning. Bells all shine like gold.
Welcome back, and that was the music of Mr. McKinley Morganfield, better known as Muddy Waters, with the tune entitled Smokestack Lightning by Willie Dixon. And we want to look back at the history of May Day, International Workers' Day, which we celebrated on Saturday here in the city of Detroit, and indeed in cities and rural areas and hamlets throughout the world. Let's listen in to this historic audio file.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. This week on the show, the incomplete, true, authentic, and wonderful history of May Day. Author, historian Peter Linebaugh joins me to discuss the history of this red and green holiday. And later in the program, Avi Lewis, filmmaker, documentary maker, discusses worker-owned factories in Argentina. All that and a few words from me on Lucy Gonzalez Parsons, an intersectional thinker way ahead of her time, and more. Welcome to the Laura Flanders Show, where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. People have heard of the holiday of May Day. They've probably usually heard either of an ancient pagan spring festival or a modern celebration of worker resistance. Well, our next guest has a new book that brings all of those holidays together. Peter Linebaugh is professor emeritus at the University of Toledo and the author of many books, including the Magna Carta Manifesto, Stop Thief, The Commons, Enclosures, and Resistance, as well as his newest, The Incomplete, True, Authentic, and Wonderful History of May Day, just out from PM Press. It is my enormous pleasure to welcome you back to the show, Peter.
It's good to be here, Laura.
So incomplete, true, authentic, and wonderful. Sounds like a good thing.
It is. It is. Hooray, hooray, the 1st of May, outdoor effing begins today.
All right. Well, tell us a few of the roots. You're taking us right into the heart of things, the spirit of it, which is clearly what animates you in the book. But for a lot of people out there, there's a pagan festival, spring festival, there's the worker day holiday, and then there's even a distress signal. How do all these relate, and which comes first?
Well, May Day is the International Emergency Distress Signal, and it's French. It just means come to my aid.
Okay.
Please help me.
So check that off the list.
Well, no, I think we need help now. I think all of us, but we can only help one another collectively. And we are in an emergency situation, at least coming from Michigan, where they're even poisoning the water.
Yeah.
Okay. So we need help, but the help must come from one another. And as you say, May Day is a day without work. It's a day without the job. It's a day without money. It's a day of fellowship. It's a day of nature loving. At a time when nature is collapsing. Nature, as May Day itself, I think, Laura, is Neolithic.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has to do with the fertility of the ground.
So that was the first May Day holiday was the Spring Festival.
Yes, exactly.
And who would celebrate now?
Who celebrates May Day now?
Well, who celebrated then and how did they do it?
Well, they celebrated many different ways in Scandinavia with barking dogs or making rough music with pots and pans or dancing around the maypole or going out in the woods and leaping over hedges and fences, and many maids went into the woods and came back different than they went out, to quote the Puritan who was opposed to May Day back in Queen Elizabeth's time.
So the first was the Spring Festival.
Yeah.
And then the workers' holiday. Before we get there, let's talk a little bit more about resistance and the U.S. experience. The Puritans went as hard as they could against May Day to try to wipe it out, right?
They did.
Who were they?
They did.
Tell us about that.
I think the story here is the green side. There's a red side and a green side to May Day. And the green side begins with Thomas Morton in 1627, erected a maypole 80 feet high in Quincy, Massachusetts, called Marymount. And there, Indians, a Ganymede, being gay people, runaway servants, even runaway slaves, danced and drank and had festivities on the 1st of May, 1627.
And you know because?
Well, you can read about it. We know about it because so much of history is written by the rulers. They went and attacked from Boston, Cotton Mather, William Bradford. They made class war against this rainbow coalition of multiculturalism that begins American history, really.
It begins American lyric poetry, you write in the book.
Yes, I do. And they said, here's a song. Now only read the last two lines. With a proclamation of the 1st of May, at Marymount we shall keep a holy day. So their notion of divine and of the sacred meant love among one another.
And we should say the Mary is M-E-R-R-Y, as in happy, not Mary as in Mary and Joseph.
Right, right. This is a secular Magnificat, we could say.
Now, the Puritans didn't like that.
No, and they didn't like it at all. The Puritans are for the control of sexuality, therefore the expropriation of the uterus. They want to, therefore, the destruction of Indians. Therefore, above all, the imposition of endless work.
You mentioned
for our sins.
Cotton Mather was one of the early, not just Puritan leaders, but also kind of traders and, commodifiers.
Exactly. He wanted to turn the earth into commodities in order to trade.
So we're talking about an economic conflict as well.
Yes, we are. There are different paths. Thomas Morton had a notion of abundance. Mather and the Puritans had a notion of scarcity, that you had to labor in the sweat of your brow for your bread, when all around you is the green world where fish and birds are there for the taking. I mean, I exaggerate somewhat. But in Virginia, the work week was 4 hours long among indigenous peoples. And this takes us to the second great story of May Day, the Haymarket story of 1886, the 1st of May, and that's the eight-hour movement.
That's right.
8 hours a day. Yeah, because right at the end of slavery times, the notion that with the 13th Amendment and the abolition of labor from sunup to sundown, comes the factory, comes the mines, comes the Gilded Age, where all that gold is for the 1%. But people from China, people from the Balkans, people from the Mediterranean, immigrants come, the Welsh, more Irish, and they come and they learn from the African-American experience that with struggle, slavery can be abolished. Mm-hmm. But they introduced racism as well. Part of the story of Lucy Parsons. Anyway, what I was going to say is that the people who developed the mechanical reaper, bringing industrialization and mechanization to the Great Plains, to the Neolithic Age, The people who actually made those machines were iron molders, and McCormick, the McCormick Reaper, his rate of profit was 71%. He cut wages by 15%. The iron molders went on strike. Four were killed by the police because McCormick and the Business Bureau of Chicago hired the police, the Pinkertons. This is the origin of police for the property developers, for the owners of the tools of production. The McCormick Reaper mechanizes Mother Earth. Now that abundance that we had with Morton, now that fertility of thousands of years becomes subject to the iron shaving of the reaper, and agribusiness prevails, ruining, by the way, the peasant life because of lower prices in Europe and the rest of the world. It's a major globalizing of the human stomach.
So the four are killed.
Four are killed. Anarchists, socialists, communists, ordinary people outraged and say, we're going to have a meeting on the 4th of May at Haymarket, which is where the hay came in, which is basically a gas station when you think about it, because it's horses that make things run, not cars, not the internal combustion engine. So at Haymarket, there's a vast crowd. It's in the evening, and a stick of dynamite is thrown after the police come to disperse the meeting. And to this day, no one's sure who threw that stick of dynamite.
Right.
Certainly among anarchists, among some, there was a cult of dynamite. Certainly among the police, there was often provocations and agent provocateur. So it remains a mystery. But what happened was a tremendous repression afterwards. Forget the law, lock them up, throw away the key, was what the sheriff said.
And several ended up being hanged.
Eight were accused. One committed suicide, Louis Ling. Four were hanged, including August Spies. And his last words, I would like to quote, if I can remember. The time will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you throttle today. That's August Spies.
One of the labor organizers who summoned the crowd to the rally and was accused and executed.
He was a part Chippewa Indian.
So bring it up to the present day. Where are we? Where is May Day? And where should it be if we were to be true to the Albert Spies, Thomas Morton legacy?
Well, first of all, it's a day without work. Second of all, it's a struggle against those who force us to work. Apartheid came down with a massive mobilization of May Day workers in South Africa. 2006, Si Se Puede in Los Angeles, Chicago, the largest May Day gathering in North America ever among undocumented Spanish-speaking Americans. That we need to remember.
Living legacy.
There's a great power in this day, in this May Day. We must remember the Haymarket martyrs. Who preserved their name in history? In America, they moved Labor Day to September. And on May Day, they called it Law Day. This is the ruling class. But the people who remembered the martyr, remembered August Spies, Albert Parsons, Engel, and Fisher, were Mexicans. They called it the Day of the Martyrs. This is an international day, and it began here in America.
Is it still today a red-green day, a day of bringing those two together and remembering some of the green roots of the red workers' resistance movement?
It has to be, Laura, because of all the talk about the Anthropocene, all the talk about climate change, all the talk about desertification, treating the Pacific Ocean as if it were a sewer. That is, the whole green side of the earth is being destroyed by capitalist imperatives of ceaseless production and accumulation and forcing work on everyone.
So if the struggle ought to continue, and I'm with you on that, and the story needs to continue to be told that there are other ways to live, the way that Thomas Merton described and practiced, and not him alone, then what do we do? What would you have us do in the media and in this country, this May Day?
Yeah, this May Day, first of all, Black Lives Matter is against this police state and against the prisons. We must open the doors of the prisons, number one. That's Jubilee. Number two, Occupy. Occupy taught us to common, taught us of mutuality, taught us about how to be responsible for our own security, taught us how to be responsible for gathering our own clean water. This is an experience. These are two experiences, I think, that we have, and many of people who are listening, I hope, will remember and have stories from those two, from those times of Black Lives Matter against the police state, basically, the racism, and Occupy. And then we gather to common and to start the discussion about what kind of world can we build.
And we do that with dancing?
Yeah.
I want to have the dancing in there.
Right.
And finally, you know, because this is such a critical issue, we talk about it so often on the program, when you say open the doors of the prison,
yes,
in the period that you're talking about, in the periods that interest you, how did people deal with conflict amongst them without locking people up and throwing away the key?
Well, the biggest conflicts were those who were taking away the land from people. And there was, but because they had the state and the army behind them, it was difficult to go up against them. And it's very hard to lock up the 1%. And I'm not sure we want to lock up the 1%. Let's give them a chance to make amends. Honest and true amends. And reparations can help them. Because we want the earth restored. We want to recuperate what's been taken from us. And when we fight those bosses, we will find that the divisions that have been imposed upon us, whether it's by gender, sexuality, racism, or age, will disappear.
So does the feminist or the women's movement slogan, "The personal is political," mean anything to you?
Political. Well, back in my day, it was Freud versus Marx, you know, so it was all books in the library. But when it came to actual creatures, fellow creatures, yeah, it's meant, its meaning only grows. Now, the notion of the person is changing, thinking of transitional people. I'm amazed at what human beings can become, what we can be. It's not just personal, though. It's also social. It's also political. And the changes can happen very quickly, very quickly. Thinking of James Connolly and the Easter Rebellion. Very quickly. Audacity, audacity, audacity. That's the rule of social change.
The book is The Incomplete, True, Authentic, and Wonderful History of May Day. It's just out from PM Press. Peter Linebaugh is the author. Peter, thank you so much for coming in.
You're very welcome, Laura.
That was Peter Linebaugh, author, historian. His new book is just out from PM Press. You can find a link at our website. Next, Avi Lewis, the filmmaker behind the movie The Take, was here recently, and I got a chance to get from him an update on the story The Take describes, the story of worker-owned and occupied factories in Argentina. Take a look. So, Avi Lewis, we have a chance to talk with you about your extraordinary film, This Changes Everything. But while you're here, I wanted to ask you about your other film, The Take, that we also featured on this
which
program.
Which came out 11 years ago.
Has it been that long?
It's been 11 years since it came out, and and 14 years since we started working on it in Argentina.
So that was a film about factory workers in Argentina who, in the financial crisis in that country, mm-hmm. instead of agreeing to be laid off, took over their factories and their means of production. Everybody wants to know how they're doing, what's going on,
I mean, you know, for people in communities to fashion local responses to global economic forces. I mean, this is just something that's captured the world's attention for very good reason. This is exactly what we need to unlock. And, you know, the folks in the movement in Argentina are doing amazingly well. There were more worker takeovers of companies in Argentina in the last year than there were in 2002 when this phenomenon started.
Except we don't hear about
that. We don't hear a word about it, but it's a very robust movement. There are networks of these cooperatives. They now have some government funding. The laws have been changed to make it easier. Struggles like the Zanon struggle, those ceramic tile makers, the largest ceramic tile factory in Latin America, 500-600 workers, democratically operated under worker control. That last year, they won the definitive expropriation and the cancellation of all of the previous owner's debts. So this movement is alive and well in Argentina, but more importantly, it's been spreading globally. And it's been so exciting as someone who helped. I was one small part of bringing this story to the world, but we know that the film has screened in factories that have been occupied by workers from Chicago, the famous Republic Windows and Doors struggle, which is now the New Era Co-op, to VOMA, which was a former pharmaceutical factory, industrial chemical factory in northern Greece, outside of in Thessaloniki, where the workers have taken over that factory and have been running it as a democratic co-op and shifting its production to green cleaning products and other more sustainable materials from a rather dangerous industrial process to much more sensitive ones in the community with the support of the community for years now. The film continues to be used by workers' movements as a source of inspiration.
And is it your sense that there is growing an ecology or a market, for lack of a better word, of these cooperative industries, businesses?
Oh, there's
they
no
can
question.
Support each other?
Yeah, I mean, this is the really exciting thing in the last few years in the United States. So the working world was this, and you've covered it on previous shows.
We had you on the show back then, 11 years ago. You, the folks from Chicago.
Yep. People from the working world, which is a democratically administered capital fund that supports worker co-ops. We had a chapter in Argentina. It's now self-sustaining and is independent from other operations around the world, 10 years old. There's one in Nicaragua. And a few years ago, Brendan Martin, my co-founder in the working world, started a chapter in the United States. And things have really taken off. The fund has millions of dollars in it. There's a 98% return rate, all supporting democratic worker-run businesses. And we're now seeing, and this is where it intersects with climate justice, which is really exciting, fence-line communities from Richmond, California, where the Chevron refinery has been poisoning people for decades, to Jackson, Mississippi, and you've covered some of the exciting developments there, are starting to turn to local community cooperative development as a response to environmental and climate and economic concerns.
But it's hard to survive alone in a capitalist economy if you don't have trading partners regionally?
And as we speak, and this could be an idea for a future segment, there is an emerging network of communities from Richmond to Jackson to right here in New York City and in the Rockaways where these communities are coming together, learning how to administer, because businesses need loans, businesses need to borrow money, but when you have worker-controlled or minority-owned or local community businesses, the banks don't necessarily recognize you as a good bet.
Right.
So there's this pool of capital that's growing and a network of people who are coming together to teach each other how to loan and repay money and how to run businesses, and it's just emerging now, and it's largely emerging in the context of the divestment movement and this divest-invest framing where people are saying, if we're going to get big institutions, municipalities, universities to divest from fossil fuels, they also need to invest in the sustainable post-carbon economy. And so these things are fusing, the worker cooperativism and the response, the local solutions to the climate and race and economic crises in this country are coming together. And, you know, maybe there's a third film in it for me. I don't know.
Yeah, I hope so.
But there's some exciting stuff going on.
Well, if there is a third film, we want you to come back and tell us about
first.
It. You can find all our coverage of the working world and the New Era Windows Company Cooperative in Chicago at our website. Thank you so much, Avi.
Pleasure.
That was filmmaker Avi Lewis. Workers shouldn't strike and go out and starve, but strike and remain in and take possession, said Lucy Parsons, lifelong partner of Albert Parsons, one of the American labor leaders most associated with the founding of the American May Day tradition. Lucy Parsons was of Mexican-American, African-American, and Native American descent. She was born into slavery, and she was an intersectional thinker and activist a century before the term was coined. Her work after emancipation led her directly into conflict with the Ku Klux Klan and into a lifelong partnership with radical typographer and organizer Albert Parsons. Lucy never ceased advocating for racial, gender, and labor justice all at once, and she's part of the movement that won us the 8-hour day. Parsons' husband, Albert, was one of the orators in Chicago who attracted thousands to a rally near Haymarket Square in 1886 on behalf of worker rights. After police charged the crowd and a stick of dynamite was thrown, he was one of those arrested and later hanged. Lucy it was who led the campaign to exonerate the Haymarket martyrs, and then she carried on their work, leading poor women into rich neighborhoods to confront the rich on their doorsteps, challenging politicians at public meetings, and marching on picket lines. She was the only woman of color and one of only two women delegates, the other being Mother Jones, among the 200 men at the founding convention of the IWW, the Militant Industrial Workers of the World. There she was the only woman to give a speech. She called women the slaves of slaves and urged the IWW to fight for equality and assess underpaid women at a lower rate for union fees. She also called for the use of nonviolence and occupation of the means of production. You can see her principles in the sit-down strikes of the 1930s in Detroit, the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, and the Occupy movement of today. She died in 42 in a house fire at the age of 89, but in the celebration of May Day, her work endures. Long may her intersectional spirit live. Do you know of intersectional work that you'd like us to know about? Write to me, laura@lauraflanders.com, and thanks.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast, and that was a discussion on the history of May Day in the United States and indeed worldwide. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program.
I'm
Welcome back, and that was the music of Memphis Minnie with the tune entitled Crazy Crying Blues. And we're going to go back and listen to more history of Lucy Parsons and the Haymarket Rebellion.
The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you are throttling today. As the final words of condemned anarchist August Baz sparked a labor revolution, a dynamic leader emerged. In the late 19th century, Lucy Parsons, the embodiment of a disenfranchised America, challenged the racist, sexist, and capitalist society surrounding her. Her radical form of activism shaped class consciousness in Chicago and the world by exploring and enlightening America's working class to the ways of revolutionary politics. Led common workers as they encountered labor struggle, explored their rights, and exchanged ideas for a better future. Few events in history have challenged the basic rights to assembly, free speech, press, and the right to a fair trial as directly as the 1886 Haymarket Affair. The 1886 Haymarket Affair was the result of years of struggling for proper working conditions. During the period leading up to the riot, workers encountered fierce opposition from business leaders and government authorities who limited their constitutional right to assemble and protest poor working conditions. So how did a band of rebels, including Lucy Parsons, affect such change in history?
Come all you workers and hear what I say. They're trying to plunder the 8-hour day. Won by our forebears in a bloody campaign. So rise up and be in the struggle again.
Most workers were working 10 to 12 hours per day, 6 to 7 days per week. Factories were filled with rats, disease, and dangerous machines. Child labor was common. The government had passed an 8-hour workday law, which it failed to enforce. Tension in America was building, with individual workers having no power. The only hope these workers had was to team up and collectively fight for their rights. A critical leader emerged named Lucy Parsons. Little is known about Lucy Parsons. She was a woman of color born in Texas and thought to be of Mexican, Native American, and African American descent. Her exact birth date is unknown. After leaving Texas, where her interracial marriage to Albert Parsons was not recognized, the Parsons landed in Illinois. She had two children. Her most recognized name was Lucy Gonzalez. Most believe she had been a slave and suggest this is why she fought so strongly for better labor rights. So how did Lucy, her husband, and her accomplices become such instrumental figures in history? Albert Parsons became involved in the railroad strike of 1877 by urging peaceful protest. In 1883, the Parsons helped begin the International Working People's Association. But it was their central role in the Haymarket Affair that solidified their place in history. The Federation of Organized Trades and Labor Unions declared May 1, 1886 to be the start of a nationwide labor movement demanding the 8-hour day. Albert and Lucy Parsons helped organize the largest rally in Chicago by marching with 80,000 workers up Michigan Avenue. On May 2nd, Albert left to set up rallies in Ohio, while Lucy organized another peaceful rally of 35,000 people. On May 3rd, policemen shot at picketing workers at the McCormick Reaper factory plant, killing at least one man. In response, a protest meeting was planned for the evening of May 4th. 20,000 people were expected, but most planned speakers did not show, and only 2,500 people attended. Eventually, two last-minute substitute speakers stepped in. They were Albert Parsons, just returning from Ohio, and Samuel Fielden, arriving from a women's sewing meeting organized by Lucy Parsons. They climbed onto a wagon and addressed the small, peaceful crowd. Near the end of Samuel Fielden's speech, with only about 200 people remaining, 176 policemen called for the meeting to disperse. At that moment, a homemade bomb was thrown into the ranks of the police, and the police shot wildly on the crowd, killing some of their own men. 7 or 8 policemen died, and at least 4 meeting attendees. The next day, martial law was declared in Chicago and across the country. Police arrested a number of people. Initially, 31 people were indicted for the murder of policeman Matthias Deegan. Most were not even at the rally. 8 prominent members of the labor movement were chosen to stand trial. The 8 anarchists were Albert Parsons, Samuel Fielden, August Spies, Louis Ling, Adolf Fischer, George Engel, Michael Schwab, and Oscar Nieb. An outraged Lucy traveled throughout the country on a campaign for the release of her husband. She made impassioned speeches about the injustices of the trial. Despite her efforts, the jury found them guilty and sentenced Nieb to 15 years in prison, while the rest of the men were sentenced to death by hanging. Fielden, Schwab, and Nieb wrote letters to the governor for clemency, and their sentences were reduced to life in prison. Albert Parsons instead wrote a letter to America for justice, and only accepting liberty or death. Engel, Fischer, Spies, and Parsons were hanged on November 11, 1887. The night before, Ling committed suicide in his cell by detonating a bomb in his mouth. Hundreds of thousands attended the funerals for the anarchists. 5 years later, Governor Altgeld pardoned the remaining anarchists from further punishment. Lucy was determined to continue the fight. In 1905, she became a founding member of the Industrial Workers of the World and began editing The Liberator, where she used the paper to fight for women's rights. She supported a woman's right to divorce and remarry, to have access to birth control, and for equal pay. She was often arrested for her beliefs. She would later spearhead a movement calling attention to the unemployed, hungry, and homeless. The 1915 Poor People's March of 15,000 unemployed women led by Lucy resulted in the federal government instituting unemployment and hunger assistance programs. In 1927, Lucy was elected to be on the International Labor Defense, where she actively aided in high-profile trials fighting for the civil rights of the victims of racism. She organized against the executions of Sacco and Vanzetti, immigrant labor activists wrongfully accused of double murder. After their execution, judicial reforms were put into place to review entire records in death penalty cases. She also defended Angelo Herndon, who faced 20 years in jail, for trying to organize black and white workers in Georgia. After his release, the Supreme Court determined the insurrection law violated union organizers' right to free speech. The ILD and Lucy were also involved in the infamous Scottsboro 9 trial. The case against 9 black boys falsely accused of raping 2 white women on a train highlighted the injustice of an all-white jury as not a jury of your peers. All defendants were exonerated. Lucy Parsons was once described as more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Upon her death in a house fire in 1942, the FBI and the Red Squad quickly removed all evidence of her writings. Despite Lucy's prolific writing and long life of activism, her name is mysteriously absent from the history books. All that remains is a small gravestone in the shadows of the Haymarket Martyrs Monument. Regardless, there is no denying she affected change and continues to impact our world today. After the Haymarket affair, workers started to believe that they could achieve better working conditions and better lives if they worked collectively. After years of protest, this spark of an event ignited the labor movement. The labor movement burst into flames and rapidly spread across the nation and the world. Employers encountered an emerging strength in their workers demanding better working conditions. But for Lucy Parsons, a woman of color, the labor movement arguably would not have seen the successes it did. Safer working conditions, an enforced 8-hour day with a minimum wage and time and a half were established. Child labor laws are strictly enforced for those under 16. Unions are protected under labor laws established since the Haymarket affair. Constitutional freedom of assembly and speech were strengthened. Unions gained strength in numbers and power. Many of those unions remain strong and continue to fight for the rights and protection of their workers. Lucy Parsons and her activists explored the landscape of labor struggles, encountered adversity and oppression, and exchanged outdated ideas for real change. The legacy of the Haymarket Affair is, out of tragedy, a stronger, healthier workforce and nation emerged. What would your world be like without Lucy Parsons and the Haymarket Affair?
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
Welcome back, and that was another audio file on the lifetimes and contributions of Lucy Parsons. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more on Lucy Parsons.
Without a south in Alabama, I got a friend called Dancing Sammy, who's crazy about all the ladies dancing, black bottom stomp and you baby fences. The other night at a thrill affair, soon as the boys found out that I was there, he said, come on, Mom, let's go to the cabaret. When I got there, you ought to hear me say, want to see the dance, just call the black bottom. I want to learn that dance. Oh, to see the dance, you call your big black bottom. They put the end of dance. All the boys in the neighborhood, they say your black bottom is really good. Come on and show me your black bottom. Come on, let's show the dance. You call your big black bottom. It put the in my bag. Early last morning, about the break of day, Grandpa told my grandmother, hear him say, yeah, and show the old man your black bottom. I wanna learn that dance. Now I'm gonna show y'all my black bottom. Wait till you see that dance. Wait until you see me do my big black bottom. It's put the end of dance.
Oh, do it, Ma. Do it, honey. Look out now, Ma. You're getting kind of rough there. You better be yourself now. Careful now. Not too strong. Not too strong, Ma.
I done showed y'all my black bottom.
Welcome back, and that was the legendary Gertrude Ma Rainey doing the Black Bottom tune and dance, if we could only see it. We'll go back to more information on the legendary Lucy Parsons.
Lucy Gonzalez, born 1853 on a Texas plantation, grows up and finds love with Albert Parsons, moves to Chicago, hoping to escape the intolerance of their interracial marriage. Chicago at this time, growing immigrant population, exploited workers, revolution is in the wind. 1877, the National Railroad Strike erupts. Government militias take the lives of 100 striking workers. 1879, Lucy is with child, working as a dressmaker, financially supporting her husband, organizing housewives, writing for the radical press. Fighting spirit, working hand, Lucy labors for the revolution. The Chicago Tribune says, "When a tramp asks you for bread, put arsenic on it and he will not trouble you anymore." Lucy responds, "Let every dirty, lousy tramp arm himself with a revolver or knife and lay in wait on the steps of the palaces of the rich and stab or shoot their owners as they come out. Let us devastate the avenues where the wealthy live, as Sheridan devastated the beautiful valley of the Shenandoah." On May 1st, 1886, workers across the country strike, demanding an 8-hour workday. Lucy and Albert lead a march of thousands. Days later, police kill striking workers in Chicago. Anarchists, communists, laborers come together in Haymarket Square. The air is still. Police come in droves, demanding the peaceful mass of workers disperse. A bomb flung from the crowd towards the police. Chaos erupts. The police shoot at workers and at themselves. The air is smoke, fury, and death. Afterwards, the state terrorizes anarchists and communists. Workers' homes are raided. Lucy is not spared. Albert is arrested along with 7 others who have nothing to do with the bomb. The state convicts these 8 men. Anarchy is on trial. Lucy tours the country, organizing a defense campaign for the Haymarket 8. Lucy says, "Had I been there, had I seen those murderous police approach, I would have flung the bomb myself. I do not stand here to gloat over the murder of those policemen, but when a ball from the revolver of a policeman kills, it is as much murder as when death results from a bomb." The state executes Albert. Lucy grieves. Lucy gets back to work. She continues writing. The police steal and destroy her pamphlets. But Lucy persists, resists, exists. She remains irrepressible. She is alive in the streets of Chicago, joining picket lines with striking workers, giving speeches, handing out incendiary leaflets. The police continue to harass her. She is unyielding. Lucy helps found the Industrial Workers of the World in 1905. At the inaugural convention, she is the only woman to give a speech, arguing that sex workers be allowed to organize with the IWW. She travels the country, speaking to workers. Eyesight failing, her heart continues the work. Lucy heads south, fighting to defend the Scottsboro Nine, the unjustly accused Angelo Herndon. In 1941, Lucy gives her last speech at the same factory that catalyzed the Haymarket Affair. 1942, Lucy dies in a house fire. 89 years of relentless struggle. 89 years of believing in the power of the working class. 89 years of believing in herself. The Chicago Police Department called Lucy more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. Lucy said of the police, "We cannot help but believe that were every law, every court, and every police officer or soldier abolished tomorrow with one sweep, we would be better off than now." May we all hope to be more dangerous than 1,000 rioters.
Welcome back. And that was another feature on Lucy Parsons. We'll close out with the words of African-American playwright Lorraine Hansberry from an address during 1964.
I wrote a letter to the New York Times recently which didn't get printed, which is getting to be my rapport with the New York Times. They said that it was too personal. What it concerned itself with was I was in a bit of a stew over the Stalin. Because when the Stalin was first announced, I said, oh, my God, now everybody's going crazy, you know, tying up traffic. What's the matter? You know, who needs it? And then I noticed the reaction starting in Washington and coming on up to New York among what we're all here calling the white liberal circles, which was something like, you know, you Negroes act right or you're going to ruin everything we're trying to do, you know. And that got me to thinking more seriously about the strategy and the tactic that the Stalin intended to accomplish. And so I sat down and wrote a letter to the New York Times. I am of a generation of Negroes that comes after a whole lot of other generations. And my father, who was you know, real American type American, successful businessman, very civic minded and so forth, was the sort of American who put a great deal of money, a great deal of his really extraordinary talents, and a great deal of passion into everything that we say is the American way of going after goals. That is to say that he moved his family into a restricted area where no Negroes were supposed to live, and then proceeded to fight the case in the courts all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. And this is the way of struggling that everyone says is the proper way to do, and it eventually resulted in a decision against restrictive covenants, which is very famous, Hansberry versus Lee. But the problem is that Negroes are just as segregated in the city of Chicago now as they were then. My father died a disillusioned exile in another country. That is the reality that I am faced with when I get up and I read that some Negroes my own age and younger say that we must now lie down in the streets, tie up traffic, stop ambulances, do whatever we can, take to the hills if necessary with some guns, and fight back, you see. Can't you understand that this is the perspective from which we are now speaking? It isn't as if we got up today and said, you know, what can we do to irritate America, you know. It's because that since 1619, Negroes have tried every method of communication, of transformation of their situation, from petition to the vote, everything. We've tried it all. There isn't anything that hasn't been exhausted. Isn't it rather remarkable that we can talk about a people who were publishing newspapers while they were still in slavery in 1827, you see? They've been doing everything, writing editorials, Mr. Wexler, for a long time, you know. And now the charge of impatience is simply unbearable. I would like to submit that the problem is that, yes, there is a problem about white liberals. The problem is we have to find some way with these dialogues to show and to encourage the white liberal to stop being a liberal and become an American radical. I think that then it wouldn't, when that becomes true, some of the really eloquent things that were said before about the basic fabric of our society, which after all is the thing which must be changed, you know, to really solve the problem, you know, the basic organization of American society is the thing that has Negroes in the situation that they are in, and never let us lose sight of it. It is entirely different, you see, the way that you would assess the Vietnamese war and the way I would, because I can't believe I can't believe that anyone who is given what an American Negro is given, you know, our viewpoint, can believe that a government which has at its disposal a Federal Bureau of Investigation, which cannot ever find the murders of Negroes, and by that method never, no, please, and shows that it cares really very little about American citizens who are black, really are over somewhere fighting a war for a bunch of other colored people, you know, several thousand miles. You just have a different viewpoint. This is why we want the dialogue, to explain that to you. I think, since we closed on a peculiar note for the break, that I, for one, would like to identify my position. Radicalism is not alien to this country, neither black nor white. And we have a very great tradition of white radicalism in the United States. And I've never heard Negroes boo the name of John Brown. So there's no problem, no matter how excited we get. I think ultimately anybody at this table who wants to read any patriot out of the Negro movement. It's not the point. Some of the first people who have died so far in this struggle have been white men. And I, for one, would be prepared, I must say, an exception to anything said, to accept the leadership of a person who gives that much devotion as against someone who would exhibit the traitorous characters of, say, a Moise Tshombe. I don't think that we can decide ultimately on the basis of color. The passion that we express should be understood, I think, in that context. We want total identification. It's not a question of reading anybody out. It's a merger, but it has to be a merger on the basis of true and genuine equality. And if we think that it isn't going to be painful, we're mistaken. I know that you, for instance, are an admirer of our late president, and he presumed, with all respect to the dead, but he happens to have been our president, so I have to talk about him that way, to have suggested to the world that if our foreign policy were not honored with regard to Cuba, that we would blow up the world, you see. And we live in a nation where everything which is talked about is talked about in terms of the fact that we are going to be the mightiest, the toughest, the roughest cats going, you know, in the whole world. And when a Negro says something about, I'm tired, I can't stand it no more, I want to hit somebody, you say that we're sitting here panting and ranting for violence, you know? It's not right. I think it's very simple that the question of the whole idea of debating whether or not Negroes should defend themselves is an insult. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.